Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use. Ladies, hello, gentlemen. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I'm Jack Fowler, the host. The star and namesake is Victor Davis Hanson. He is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. He has a website, The Blade of Perseus. The address is victorhanson.com. I'll tell you more about why you should be subscribing to that later on in this podcast. We are recording on Saturday, March 16th, and this episode will be up on Thursday, March 21st. So when I get done with this, Victor, I might start celebrating St. Patrick's Day a little earlier than planned for, but there's nothing wrong with that. Hey, we've got a lot to get your wisdom on today, Victor. I think we should start off by discussing the Biden administration unlocking billions of dollars for Iran. And we'll do that, Victor, right after these important messages.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We are back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, here's a headline. Biden administration renews Iran's sanctions waiver that unlocks upward of $10 billion for the regime. And this is from the Washington Free Beacon. The Biden administration on Wednesday, and I forgive the dog here whining in the background, sorry, on Wednesday reapproved a sanctions waiver that unlocks upwards of $10 billion in frozen funds for the Iranian government. The sanctions waiver, which has drawn fierce GOP opposition on Capitol Hill, allows Iraq to transfer electricity payments to Iran via third-party country. The sanctions waiver was last approved by the Biden administration and in November and set to expire this month, putting the White House in a tight position, et cetera, politics, et cetera. Victor, the bodies of the people of the three soldiers Iran have recently killed are still not culled. They have never been, I think, justly retaliated against for the death of those three soldiers in Jordan recently. Victor, this is, like many things, I'm sorry to abuse this word, madness of the Biden administration. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you sound like Alec Guinness, you remember, or when he fell on the explosive device at the end of the Bridge of Liberquai, and I think Jack Hawkins yelled, "This is madness,
Oh,
madness."
the doctor looking on the
Oh,
hill.
yeah, that was the doctor that
Yeah.
yelled that, and it's hard to make sense of it. It really is. I mean, we did pay 1.2 billion per hostage. Remember that? We got the That was 6 billions, I think, the Koreans released under our pressure. So the question is, what is this fascination with Iran? And Obama was the one that really inaugurated it, and Biden is carrying it through. They've got, and why would they appoint Robert Malley, this pro-Iranian hack? It's really hard to decipher. And why would they be so eager to pay $1.2 billion for a hostage, an American held by the Iranians, but we have a lot more of them that are held by Hamas, and they're not interested in getting them back. So there is something that's it's almost inexplicable, and it gets back to this Obama crackpot Ben Rhodes idea that you're going to balance all of our friends, the Gulf monarchies, Jordan, Egypt, Israel, by creating this tension with promoting Iran and the Assads and Beirut and Hamas. And then we're going to step in every once in a while and adjudicate wars, I guess. But it doesn't make any sense. Iran is our enemy. It's killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans during the Iraq War. It attacks us all the time. And yet they have some kind of inexplicable soft spot for this theocracy. It just I can't even explain it. It just makes no sense. And Trump
Victor, at the
finally he tried to stop the Obama appeasement when he killed Soleimani and he went after some Iranian. But even he, because there were people in his State Department and his Defense Department that were restraining him all the time about Iran, he didn't retaliate until things he could have, because there's a deep state infatuation with this theocracy. I don't know what it is, but
yeah.
it's really against our interest,
When you
given
have
what they
these
do.
powwows at Hoover, and where these kind of matters are discussed, and I'm assuming this has been discussed, this Obama infatuation policy, does anyone come and try to make the case for it? I know you take in all kinds of voices when you do these kind of
Well, we have
gatherings.
some people who come and from the Democratic Party during the Obama people who are now, I mean, Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken were not quiet during the Trump administration and during the, they were Obamaites. And remember, Jake Sullivan was involved in the Alpha Bank Ping hoax. Remember that hoax? He was the one that was trying with Sussman to promote it and get it out to the media, even though it was false. And Blinken was the one that called up Mike Morrell and tried to round up the 50. So these people go that I'm just mentioning them because they happen to be our two top, Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor. They're the architects of our policy right now. And they are hardcore Obama era partisans, and they make sure that the National Security Council and people around them in the State Department, in the case of Blinken, are for this policy. And as soon as they came in, they wanted to restart the Iran deal. As soon as they came in, they wanted to make sure the Houthis were not designated terrorists. As soon as they came in, they started to adjudicate gas fields off the coast of Israel and Beirut in a matter that was not favorable to Israel. As soon as they came in, they tried to distance themselves from Israel. So they have this fixation. And yeah, it appears sometimes. We had a debate the last day of the COVID, the first day of the COVID lockdown, or the night before, we debated the Iran deal. And we had one member of the Hoover fellows and a visiting scholar, and they've debated H.R. McMaster and myself. And he wasn't originally for the Iran deal pullout when he was national security advisor, but he quickly saw that Trump was, and as a good, you know, a loyal advisor, he got on board. And he and I debated these two people who thought that the United States should stay in the Iran deal and promote it. So, yeah, but I still don't understand the fixation with Iran. There's a lot of Iranians in the United States. And remember, there's two waves of Iranian immigrants. There's the first group that came before, right on the eve of the Shah falling. These were very conservative, very pro-American. Many of them were Jewish. They tended to settle in Los Angeles, places in California. When you meet them today, they're in their 70s and their 80s. They're in business. They're very successful. And then there's a second wave. And these people were the socialist secular Iranians who thought that Khomeini would be a useful tool in getting rid of the Shah dictatorship. So when they got rid of the Shah and all the right-wing business people left, then they figured that because they played a prominent role, they would be big players in the new Iranian EU socialist-like republic. And what they didn't figure was they were useful idiots, because Khomeini came in and he started executing, of course, all the Shah people, but them too. And he went after them, and then they fled. And that second wave came after the fall of the Shah, and they were not entrepreneurial, pro-American to the same degree. They right. were journalists, academics, media, lawyers, professors. And so when you meet somebody, they're a little bit younger, but when you meet Iranian Americans today, they fall into two categories: hyper-patriotic, pro-American, pro-Israel, many of them Jewish, and then kind of very critical of America, very critical of Israel, talk about Mossadegh every sentence. So there's two different groups. And but I don't understand. And the second group tends to vote strongly Democratic and feel, and is what I'm getting at, and supports this outreach program, the Iran deal, et cetera, with this crazy hope that the more we appease Iran, people like them that are still in Iran are going to, you know, rise up and vote out or get rid of the theocracy. Then they're going to make a nice European, like, socialist democracy.
Wow.
And I don't think that's going to happen without a lot of bloodshed.
Well, Victor, I'd like to take a moment for our sponsor today. One of them, Field of Greens. Field of Greens is the healthiest thing you can do every day, folks. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy, and I promise you're going to love the product. But if for any reason you don't, they'll give you a 100% money-back guarantee. I got you 15% off the first order, plus free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code Victor. That's promo code Victor, V-I-C-T-O-R, at fieldofgreens.com, fieldofgreens.com. And we thank Field of Greens for sponsoring the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, wow, one of your favorite people in the world, Sam Bankman-Fried. You remember him? His lawyers.
Yeah, I remember the helicopters that flew over my apartment looking for him, the paparazzi.
Well, I know where he is right now. Yeah, his lawyers are arguing for his sentencing. And I don't know, but, you know, we're recording on Saturday. The show's up out on Thursday. So something may be rendered in the intervening time. But the interesting thing about his lawyer's argument, and there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying this sounds like it might be quite counterproductive, arguing on that his altruism should lessen his sentence. And you remember Fried was one of these altruistic philanthropy,
yeah.
And I'm doing all this, all I'm doing here is so I can, you know, make money or steal money and then bankroll good things, which to you and me and many others are bad things. Any thoughts you have, Victor, on this latest chapter in the life of one of America's great business minds and criminals?
Well, I was a student at Stanford, and then I taught there as a visiting professor, and now I've been there since 2003. And the Bankman-Fried parents were very prominent. They were both professors at the law school. One of them was in left-wing tax policy and how to make it more fair to the exploited, and the other was an activist. And she, as you remember, had it moonlighted as a bundler for Silicon Valley people who wanted to support the more radical, like the squad type politicians, but didn't want to be known doing that. So she had kind of a pack, and she ran that. And then, of course, the Sun at one point was worth $30 to $40 billion with this cryptocurrency, and then started to manipulate and tap into his people's accounts when he lived it up, spent a lot of money, but also was speculating when the market went bad on cryptocurrency. And now they're all involved in criminal proceedings, and the parents either are testifying or they're directly charged, but they had property transfers. And the whole thing is just, it's just, anybody looks at Stanford Law School, they see things like that, that professors have been embarrassed getting in politics. We had the Judge Dunkett incident. We've had all of these embarrassments, and they all have a common theme that very, very left-wing people like a lot of money. They like a lot of money. And they always say they're doing it for us. He wanted to manipulate the markets. He wanted to speculate. He wanted to tap into people because he wanted to help us. And that's what Mark Zuckerberg, he didn't want to give $419 million to basically corrupt the balloting, but he did because he wanted to help us. Same thing with Michael Bloomberg. So I don't listen to anything they say. Because yeah. Everything they say is untruthful, because it's always, I did this for humanity. At least Bernie Madoff was an upfront crook. I'll take an upfront crook any day over, I did it for you. I did it for humanity. I was trying to create a progressive era, that kind of stuff. I was working for the underprivileged. I wanted to make sure that kind of, remember the father and said, oh, but he was getting $250,000. Right. And he said, well, by the way, Sam promised me $1 million, that kind of stuff.
Tax-free.
They were very acquisitive for people who were socialist.
Yeah, well, Stalin had his DACA also. So
they all, that's the way the socialism, as everybody knows, it's kind of a psychological squaring the circle of people who have obsessive material wants, and they feel guilty about that because they just want stuff and they want money and they want privilege. And so they get them through socialism or hard left democratic politics or progressivism. And then they say, you know what? I don't feel guilt anymore. I'm helping the poor in the abstract. I'm supporting issues for the exploited. And that's why it, you know, when we were growing up, they used to call them limousine liberals, but we've gone
I'm
way
living
beyond
in this
that.
Mansion on behalf of all of you.
Yes, that's
like
what it was.
BLM, the
it's
BLM it, founders, right?
The three architects who stole the money and all ended up with beautiful homes. We don't hear much of them, except that every once in a while they crawl out of their mansion and accuse people of being racist who mentioned that. Our Professor Kendi, remember his Kendi Research Center and his $30,000 for a Zoom, 30 minutes to tap into his genius? Then we find out, well, he didn't publish anything. They didn't do anything. He had to lay them off. They went through $50 million. But you're racist for saying that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice work if you can get it. Hey, Victor, we're going to talk about another favorite person of yours, Kamala Harris. She's been on an abortion clinic tour. We'll get your thoughts on that right after these important messages.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date.
Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, I think today, the day this is coming out, maybe the first day of spring. I forget. Maybe the equinox is the 21st or the 22nd. Anyway, we're on the cusp of cooking outside, grilling. I'm sure people are already doing that somewhere in these great United States. So barbecue is a word that makes your mouth water, and you may already have a low temperature, slow cooking smoker, egg or pellet barbecue, Victor Davis Hanson Show listener. But in the middle of your busy week, who has that kind of time? You need a hot, fast solar infrared gas grill. It heats up to 1,000 degrees in just 3 minutes, even on cold winter nights. That heat locks in juices and flavor and grills food faster in just a few minutes. Your family will be sitting at the table enjoying delicious, better than restaurant quality grilled food, juicy steaks, moist chicken, tender fish, and healthy grilled veggies. Solair is a multi-generational veteran-owned business. Their portables, carts, and built-ins are all made in the USA from commercial grade stainless steel, so they are built to last. Get your free guide, how to choose the right infrared grill, at besthotgrill.com. That's besthotgrill.com. Solair infrared gas grills for fast, delicious grilled food every day. That's besthotgrill.com, besthotgrill.com. And we thank the good people from Solair for sponsoring the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, once upon a time, Bill Clinton talked about abortion being, you know, safe.
Safe, legal, and rare. Yeah. I remember that.
No, but and now it's full blown sacrament.
Yeah,
so,
I remember.
So was it Kamala Harris? Go ahead.
Wasn't it Governor Casey of Pennsylvania? Was he senator? That he was the father of the current Casey. He was always fighting the Democratic radicals to make sure
Bob Casey, who I knew a little, and actually his son was my classmate at Holy Cross. Offline, I'll tell stories. But his dad, Pennsylvania was, I think, the fifth largest state population at the time. He could not, he was denied speaking to the Democratic Convention.
I remember that.
And he was, with Nat Hentoff, who was a great liberal in the classical liberal sense, a columnist at for the Village Voice, he tried to have a talk with him at Cooper Union. This is one of the first big precursors of the forthcoming cancellation and shout him down trends. And yeah, the New York City audience, that was, I think, 1984, 85, 86. Bob Casey could not speak. He was a voice for the unborn in a party of ethnic Catholics. The pro-life movement in America came from Catholic Democrats. There is not a single Catholic Democrat pro-life in the Congress anymore.
There isn't. And it's a big lie that Roe versus Wade cut down on abortions. I mean, in 2023, I think we're almost, I think they got up over 900,000 of them, 95 or 98% of what it was 4 years ago.
Yeah. So 60 million since Roe.
Yeah. And we have, they don't like to talk. They always say, it's 2 or 3%, about 5% of abortions are past 16 weeks, late term abortions, partial birth. But it's about 5 to 10,000 a year that are viable babies that that pass through the birth canal that have to be killed in the process before they emerge into the real world. And we don't talk about that. So it was always considered kind of a tragic thing when a woman had an abortion for whatever reason, whether you supported it or you oppose it. But for her to go to an abortion clinic, it's part of this rebranding of Kamala Harris. Her advisors obviously went to her and said, you know what, everybody's thinking you're a dunce and you're an embarrassment and you poll lower than any major politician in America except Mitch McConnell. And we've got to do something. And they said, why don't you be the left wing lightning rod? So you'll talk about all the exploitation of poor little immigrants that came in here illegally, unlawfully. You can be really strident on abortion. You can carve out this position of the hardcore left as you prepare yourself, perhaps in 2024, to take up the mantle when Joe Biden is either, you know, unable to run or drops out or something. So I think this is part of her remake, but it's kind of weird that you have the vice president of the United States celebrating an abortion clinic. The Democratic Party didn't used to do that.
Yeah.
And you would think that they're, you know, that it used to be that this is a tragedy and that when people have an abortion, if you happen to favor that, it's something that should be, it's tragic. But the idea that people on the left celebrate it, and you look at our fertility, I mean, we're 1.7. It's part of a larger cult of, I don't want to say death, but anti-fertility, where we have this new ethos, and AOC sort of said it, we don't want to have, our generation doesn't want to have children because of climate change or something. Younger people in this generation are not marrying in their 20s. They're not having the 2.1 children average, and we're declining in population. And abortion, you know, when you lose 900,000 per year, and it's kind of, I don't like to talk personally, but I have a daughter who has a child that she knew would be severely disabled. It's called Smith-Magenis. It's more severe in some ways than Down syndrome. And of course, she had she went to full term, and my granddaughter's a beautiful little girl. She's 90, she's severely disabled, and she has to be in special needs, and she has meltdowns. But the idea that she wouldn't be here is unthinkable. And I'm not suggesting other people do that, because it's changed my daughter's life. She's not able to work outside the home. She requires a lot of care, Lila does. But
right,
the pluses of having her around, she's such a wonderful little child. And so
your daughter's a rarity.
The reason I'm kind of baffled is that I think most Americans, when young people get into a situation or they're pregnant and they understand the pressures that it's an illegitimate or all of these things. But so they want to find ways to accommodate this tragedy, but they don't want to look at it as an abortion on demand, late term abortion, okay.
Right.
Let's just brag about it. You know what I mean? And that's what going to an abortion clinic really is. And that's why it's so strange that there's almost no penalties for disrupting or bombing a pro-life center, but an adoption agency. But there really is. They go after people who protested abortion centers, and they send them to 20 years if they can. It's really weird. I asked Merrick Garland about that. You remember that crazy, lame excuse he did? He basically said, well, we can't catch them because when you try to bomb a pro-life, they do it at night. And when they protest a pro-abortion, they do it today. And what he was really saying was, the really hardcore terrorists that bomb thing and try to destroy, they go after pro-life. And the mom and pops who demonstrate against abortion, they do it during the day, so we're going to go after them. That was the lamest thing I ever heard of him say.
Well, maybe the great border czar, Kamala Harris, maybe there should be an abortion clinic on the border.
I thought she was space czar. Remember, she hired that little group of actors to ask her questions to show her genius about outer space.
She's many czars.
Yeah. She's abortion czar. She's border czar. She's space czar. She's everything but.
She's bizarre. Sorry. That was bad. Hey, Victor, quick headline thought, and then I want to get your broader thoughts on issues of sports and college. But there was a headline I saw yesterday preparing for these podcasts we're recording here on the 16th. It's titled, House May Refer January 6th Committee Members for Prosecution. And this has to do with the destruction of evidence by the committee members.
And I can't believe they would do such a thing.
Yeah.
Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, they wouldn't do that. The only reason they were on the committee, remember, they had two requisites. That was I think that was the first time in memory, or maybe in history, where the speaker refused the nominations for a committee from the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy.
Yes, right.
And then Nancy Pelosi basically said, if you want to be in this committee, you got to do two things. You got to be inert, so you have no political future. So you're either not going to run or you're going to lose the next election. And you have to have voted to impeach Donald Trump. And that's who was on it. Both of them had prior voted to impeach Trump. Both of them had no political futures. And that wasn't even a committee. It was just a witch hunt.
We were talking on our last podcast, you were talking about the double standard in the rule of laws and how these people won't be prosecuted for the various obvious crimes they've committed. But this plays right into that. The destruction of evidence, and knowingly that when the incoming, although it took him a while to become speaker, Kevin McCarthy said, "Don't touch any of this. We want it," and it all magically disappeared. But they will not pay a price. If the shoe was on the other foot, right? You pay a price. If you walk by the Capitol on January 6th, you may be prosecuted by.
It's so weird, and I don't know how. What I'm really curious about: should Trump win, what does the FBI do? Because the FBI in 2016 hired Christopher Steele as a contractor and paid him money, and an FBI lawyer, Kevin Sussman, forged a FISA document, and the FBI head, James Comey, was knee-deep in it, the Russian collusion. And remember, he lied and said that Donald Trump was not under investigation. He told Trump that. He had a private meeting with Donald Trump. He went out in his car and recorded it on an FBI device and had a third party leak it to the New York Times. And then his successor, Andrew McCabe, as I said earlier, lied four times. So given that record, and then they did that in the entire Robert Mueller, former FBI, that whole farce of the Mueller investigation. And then we had the performance art raid on Roger Stone, FBI raid on James O'Keefe, that thing, the FBI Mar-a-Lago raid. And then in addition to that, we've had Christopher Wray with the FBI agents at parents' meetings. What's going to happen to the FBI if Donald Trump wins? It's really could you trust the FBI if you were him when they have spent the last 8 years trying to destroy him at the very top level? It's really interesting to see that. I don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to have an answer.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we'll be back to 2017. I don't know if you remove Christopher Wray and you get someone who's apolitical, a former FBI high-ranking official. But then even then, I mean, how many people in the FBI were involved with Twitter and Facebook and monitoring news to suppress any mention of the laptop? Or remember, the FBI had the laptop in their possession at the very time 51 quote-unquote intelligence authorities were assuring the country right before a debate and right before the election that this laptop was a product of Russian disinformation. Likely, it's the little weasel word they use. And the FBI didn't say a word. They had it. They knew it was authentic. So if I were Donald Trump and you, I think you'd have to either take a chance and fire the top 20 people in the Washington office, the Peter Strokes type people. Or I would just take each division, you know, the counterfeit division, the terrorist, anti-terrorist division, the racketeering mafia divisions, and I would just outsource them. This one goes to the Department of Justice, stays in Department of Justice. This one goes to Homeland Security. This one goes to Treasury, and break them up.
Yeah.
Because there's just too much power in Washington, and that's too, and they can't handle it. They're not trustworthy.
Well, I know the Heritage Foundation is preparing all sorts of things for the, if in the case of an oncoming Trump administration, that it might be prepared from day one. I don't think it was prepared from day one.
No, the last report, 20,000 names are supposedly. I don't think I don't think the Mooch is going to be on it. I don't think the Omarosa is going to be on it. I don't think Anonymous is going to be on it. I knew Steve Bannon at one time. I liked him, but I don't think Steve Bannon is going to be on it.
Right.
So who's going to be?
Well, names aside, I would just hope there's some anticipation or some preparation for what to do with some of these agencies like the FBI that have really are so far afield from their old standing public perception. And Victor, I you talked about, you know, lopping off the top 20, but I kind of have a feeling there's a sense of like what we've talked about many times with the military, the golden, you know, pot of gold that lies there in retirement, and that this must be deep within the FBI. I know how to make dough after I do my 20, 25 years, whatever it takes.
Are you referring to James Baker, chief legal counsel of the FBI, who helped try to spread the Steele dossier? Remember, he was the one that met with, I think, BuzzFeed or some of those people on the eve. And then guess what? He was the one that, I guess, was point man in having the FBI work with Twitter contractors to suppress unfavorable news to Biden. And he went from a salary of 200 something to $7 million as chief counsel of Twitter, until the unbelievable happened to him. Elon Musk took over the company, and I think the first thing he did was fire him.
Well, the perversion of the culture, I think, must be deep and more deeply troubling than we even want to imagine. So,
speaking though, very quickly of Elon Musk, did you see this morning his encounter with Don Lemon?
Don Lemon, but Lemon, we'll call him that.
He hired him to do to have an interview show or something on X.
Right.
And the first one was with Elon Musk. And he started attacking Elon Musk. I couldn't believe it. The questions, you know, are you gonna stop disinformation? You're gonna do this, and Elon Musk said, you know, I don't really have to do this interview. And then he got all angry, and he thought, and then I don't know if it's accurate. Maybe it was they're back and forth with each other. But they published this morning what he wanted is he wanted a Tesla truck, you know, electric truck.
Right.
He wanted $5 million in addition to $8 million salary. He and his boyfriend or his fiance wanted free massages and drinks at Las Vegas hotel, and you wanted and I guess he really thought he had market value, but after he had been fired, he had the lowest ratings on one of the lowest rated show networks, CNN. He had no market value,
right?
And yet he was jacking up Elon Musk, who's very sensitive to the realities of market value.
Right.
So he just basically said, see ya, wouldn't want to be ya. And now he's all angry. He's angry. It's just bizarre.
Maybe he'll go to one of those bars out on the in the Hamptons and encounter somebody.
Down someone's pant.
Yeah.
It almost tells me that Elon Musk knows that he's unstable and he wanted to hire him, because he knew what he would do, and then fire him and make a point. I don't know.
Well, I tweeted at or X'd at Elon Musk this morning in response to that, that he should, if he's looking for shows, he should have a Victor Davis Hanson show instead of a Don Lemon show. Hey, Victor, we have a little time left, And I'd like to raise the issue of get your thoughts on college sports and girls in sports, and we'll get to that right after this final important message.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, before I raise some sporting issues with you, I want to tell our listeners that our God-given freedoms are facing unrelenting attacks. It's a battle for truth, and the only way we can win is if we stand together. Thankfully, Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF, has been defending our rights for 30 years and winning. Right now, they're involved in two critical cases before the Supreme Court. The first, they're suing the FDA for endangering the health and safety of women and girls. And in the second case, they're assisting the state of Idaho to defend its law protecting the lives of women and their unborn children against the Biden administration's attempt to override the law and force doctors to perform abortions. Talk about twisted. ADF needs your help. With your best gift, you courageously join the ADF in fighting critical Supreme Court cases against government lawlessness and help defend our cherished freedoms. Go to joinadf.com/Victor. That's joinadf.com/Victor to give now. With your help, I've pledged to raise $5,000 by March 31st for ADF. Visit joinadf.com/Victor to make your best gift right now. I know with your help, we can beat that goal and help make a generational difference for freedom. We thank the Alliance Defending Freedom for sponsoring the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, I have two things sports related. And one is just college sports in general, which are, you know, the college sports of 2024, whatever the hell year we're in, I was going to say 1924, are quite different than they from 10 years ago. Never mind when your father was playing college football back in the day. I think, you know, college sports are important in some ways, but many ways. But anyway, what's your, you've been a teacher. You've been at colleges your whole life. Hoover's on the campus of Stanford, which is has some of the great sports programs, college sports programs. What are your general thoughts about college sports and how they fit into the culture and institution of a college? And are you troubled by any trends?
Well, I used to, when I was a young teenager, one of my great remembrances was that my father and my mom, who was a graduate of Stanford, and she went got a BA and a law degree, and her sister, and we would go up there and watch the mighty Jim Plunkett. Remember him? And I just loved that guy as quarterback. He was wonderful. He was really he to me idolized the perfect athlete. He was like a rock. He was about 6'4". He was solid muscle. He wasn't flashy.
Didn't he lead
flashy.
Oakland in the Super Bowl?
He did. And then he was in San Francisco. Then he was kind of washed up. And I think he was with the Patriots originally, but he had a bad line and he just was beat the hell up. He wasn't really quick on his feet. He wasn't a rollout but he just took like 6 years of just hit after hit. And then he went to San Francisco and he had some trouble. And then he just shined under Al Davis at Oakland, I think 2 Super Bowls. But he was, you'd watch him at Stanford. He had his arm was like a cannon. He could just hit somebody 40, 50 yards. And I just loved it. We would always go up and say, can we see Jim Plunkett? So we went up there 4 or 5 times his junior and senior year. And that was before they'd remodeled the Stanford Stadium. It was the old amphitheater type seats, and they had the track there and everything. So I have a long attachment, and my dad was a community college and high school football coach at Reedy High School and Reedy College way back in the 50s. So every time I would go to some place, you know, for a tire store in Fresno, some guy, hey, coach, he had hundreds of former, and he played for Alonzo Stagg, he and his first cousin, who they kind of adopted, Victor Hansen, at the University of Pacific. Victor was
what? Really, your dad played for Amos Alonzo Stagg?
He was a little farm boy from Kingsburg, and he was 6'3", and his first cousin, whose father was blinded in a farm accident, whose mother died during his birth, grew up with him. And he was about 6'4", about 210. He was the one that was killed in the 6th Marine Division in Okinawa the last day at Sugarloaf Hill. But the two of them then got complete full scholarships to play two tight ends. One was a tight end, one was a tight end.
Right.
For 2 years with Stagg at University of Pacific, used to be a known football
powerhouse.
Not quite a powerhouse, but known. And then I have various, you know, certificates on my wall where he was offered to try out for the New York Giants, but it was like, we'll pay you for play for us for 1 year for $500.
Yeah.
It was, and I think when I was growing up, we had his helmet, you know, those leather things that looked like stocking caps or something. And I think he was in pain most of his life because he destroyed both of his knees. He had a separated shoulder. He knocked out a lot of his teeth and playing football. And he suggested that I did it for 3 years. My brother was really good at it. He did it for 3, much better than I was, but I still have banged up stuff. But anyway, my attitude is it's become a big multi-million dollar. In those days, the coaches made the equivalent today of about $100,000. They weren't getting $10, $20 million. And so something had to change, but the idea that these guys are going to be unionized and professional sports, I don't know where we're going, but it's kind of de facto like they're professional athletes right now, because they're not, I mean, at that level of play and that level of time and devotion, how in the world could you actually go to school and do your studies? I mean, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether they should have clubs like the Stanford Football Club, where they just get semi-pros. I don't know, but it's not working. When I was at Cal State, I was there for 21 years, and they had an informal list of professors you should not take. Can you imagine that? They had a great coach. He was very colorful. If you ever remember, Jim Sweeney. And he had been really, you know, well-known. I think he had backfield coach. And anyway, he was very successful at Fresno State, but they had a list. I saw him once walking Ross campus, and he came up to me and said, you know, I have nothing against you. I just don't want my students taking your class. But I had
on the list, right?
Yeah, I had a humanities class, and there was a guy who must have been 6'9 and 300 pounds. He was their first string guard. And I don't know why he wanted to take my humanities of the Western world. So he came in the first week. And I said, I don't think you're in the right class. He said, I'm in the right class. I just want to learn literature. I said, but you've got like 2 practices in August. And he said, I said, I want to take this. So he tried to come to the classes, but he flunked the first exam. And then I got the academic coordinator for the football team would call. Professor Hansen, I'm the academic coordinator for the football team, and Mr. Smith is in your class. He should never have been in your class. We told him not to be in your class. He cannot get an F in your class. We want a C. And I said, I can't do that. I'm sorry. And they said, well, we want him to withdraw from your class. I said, it's past the withdrawal date. But if you can go to the president and you can get an exemption, I'll sign it. So that's what they did. But he was a nice guy. And I had a really good classics student who was a quarterback. And he basically broke his back the first year at Fresno State, and he had his scholarship. They were very good about it. They honored his scholarship. And he went from a quarterback to being a classics major. And he actually was very brilliant. His name was Nick Rockwell. He's a really good guy. And he got his bachelor's, and then he got his PhD at UCLA, and he became a professor for a while. And so I had a lot of contact with college sports, but something that there's no good answers why I'm struggling, because these are basically, it's like, it's not like baseball, it's not like semi-pro or farm leagues or ABC league or something like that, AAA, AA, A league. That's a lot more honest, and so, but I don't know what you do. But now the idea you're going to have a bunch of unionized professional student athletes who are making a lot of money. Why not just go to the pros? I don't understand it. It's going to kill. I think it's going to kill college football.
Yeah.
I think it will, because there'll be no need to go to college. If you're a good high school athlete, maybe they'll have a AAA football team or something like that. And maybe the alumni will have to find something else to go to, because it's not going to work.
That's the money issue. And then if you throw in the cultural issue where, can you not believe that within a year or two, there'll be five guys who are saying we're the women's team for, pick a college.
Yeah, that and that, or that. I think Dartmouth's basketball team is unionizing now, right? We're on strike. We're not going to play unless we get this.
Yeah.
And the whole transgender thing, as you mentioned. And I mean, I think the last 6 months, there's been four or five cases where women athletes, but more important, even women, grown women that are in community gyms that go to the locker room to shower, and they see quote unquote female with male genitalia, and they get really freaked out. And usually they're chastised or kicked out or punished for being freaked out.
Some lady, this isn't related to college, but the older lady was fired from her gym. She can't go there anymore because she complained. She was at the community gym, and she was in the shower, and there's a guy with his Johnson dangling or whatever the hell, and she bitched about it to the front desk, and they're like, you're the one with the problem.
Yeah, I don't think there's certain things that have gone on in our society that are so transformative, and they come about so radical that they're not going to be sustainable. And one of them is the DEI woke czar. And another one is the transgendered male and female sports. It's not going to be sustainable.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. I think people are going to rebel against it. And I think it's going to be an issue in the upcoming election. And I think a lot of people, when they look at what woke has done to the university, and if they were to win, they being the conservatives, were going to win the House and the Senate and the White House, I think there's going to be a big drive to tax endowments and to start looking very carefully at student loans, and starting to look very carefully at putting strings on federal research money that these universities, if they're going to take federal monies, they're going to have to follow certain regulations that they don't now, like protection of free speech, et cetera.
Right.
The era of we're going to give you tax-free every year on your $3 billion income from your endowment, and we're going to allow you to raise money tax-free because you're a nonprofit, and we're going to give you tax-free, huge multi-billion-dollar grants, and we're going to subsidize all your students to the tune of $2 trillion, and we're going to do all that while you shout down speakers you don't like, and you have segregated dorms by race, and you have segregated graduation ceremonies, and you have segregated safe spaces, and you disrupt people's, you hunt down Jews in the library and lock them in if you're students. I don't think that's sustainable. And I think they're going to take, they being the conservative, if they win, are going to take some pretty strong measures.
Yeah.
I think Stanford and Harvard and Yale should just go the Hillsdale route. You know, Hillsdale did not want to deal with an oppressive left-wing government. And maybe Stanford and Harvard and Princeton just said, you know, I like what Hillsdale did, and I do not want to deal with an oppressive conservative government. So we have our own endowment, and we don't want any federal funds, period, none. And we're, and students that come here with GI Bill, and they can't do it. And that's what the federal government punished Hillsdale by doing. And maybe that's a model they should all do.
Because you and I are involved in nonprofit matters, but there's a quid pro quo here that nonprofit, which is not a right, there's not a right to nonprofit status, but the essence of it is you're doing a public good, and therefore you're doing something that needs to be done, and therefore you are granted this status. And if these colleges and the collective are not doing things that are good, or implying they're doing good by educating, raising this money to educate, and then they don't spend the money on education, first of all, they're still charging frickin' $80,000 a year while they're sitting on $30 billion endowments. It's a very legit.
Well, I mean, if you're walking across the Stanford campus, as I am, to my office, and there's a permanent 4 or 5 month Gaza camp, and people are screaming at the top of their lungs in your face from the river to the sea, and you kind of have to sidestep them, and then there's chalk messages on the cement, and they cannot stop that. That's the longest occupation of the Stanford campus. And nobody could say, you know what? No one else can do that. If you're a vendor or you're a homeless person, we do not let you camp out on the middle of the quad and obstruct foot traffic and yelling people, and we're not going to, they couldn't, they did. They finally, after 4.5 months, did. But, you know, when you walk by and there's a sign that says, shh, be quiet, do not wake protesters, and they're in their pup tents, you know, it's surreal. And the universities have lost all moral authority. They really have. And they allow what we saw in my campus with Judge Duncan, when you had a federal judge that was basically hounded and run off campus for not using the correct pronouns in a case.
Right.
And the DEI person hijacked his lecture and pre-planned. She had a written script to replace it with. There has to be some reaction to all of that. That's been good. Claudine Gay's testimony. You could see something is basically wrong. And when you look at the cost, as you said, the money is, it's too expensive. The return and the cost benefit analysis is too little. Half the young people in America do not go to these colleges, and yet as taxpayers, they subsidize them. They don't get student loans, but they have to underwrite these defaults. It's not sustainable. We need a massive vocational program. And the idea that you're going to turn 18 and you're going to go to one of these campuses and you're going to take, as half the students do, you're going to take 6, 9 units, 8 units, and then maybe half the students don't graduate. And the ones that do take 6 years on average in higher education. But you're just going to, I don't know, throw away your 20s while you sort of kind of are maybe not a psych major, environmental studies major, whatever. It's not. And you're not going to get married. You're not going to be a taxpayer. You're not going to buy a house. You're not going to have children. You're not going to develop skills. You're just going to be on this campus world of kind of sort of a student while you get indoctrinated with these bankrupt leftist ideas. And the word that we, the taxpayer, are going to subsidize it. I don't think it's going to work anymore.
Yeah. Well, Victor,
now the president of Harvard University is a known plagiarist. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and well, we should wait till this Ackman, I believe he has spent his money, some of his couch change, to do a deep dive into all all these administrators and DEI people, and just to vet them on the plagiarism front. So I think there are a lot more trees to fall in these scandals. Victor, there was one other thing. We have time, but there's a great piece I want to recommend to our listeners. It's on the Federalist by Zachary Mettler, and it's titled, Where Are the Dads Protecting Their Daughters from Dangerous Male Athletes? And it has nothing to do with college athletics, but I think, Victor, we've all seen these videos of this game up in Massachusetts where this, brute of a guy at a basketball game playing as a girl knocked the crap out of three girls. And there are other examples of this across the nation, but maybe it's time for some dads to come out of the stands and say, not doing this to my daughter. You're not putting my daughter at risk.
Yeah. That would be
might lance the boil.
Well, I mean, it reminds me of that scene. Remember, was it Huey or whatever his name was, Morgan, and Hal Greenwood, My Valley, Roddy McDowell?
Oh, when he kept beaten by the teacher?
And the teacher was this little snotty-nosed wannabe academic or something, and he got caned, and then the other kids beat him up, and then the whole family rallied, and they got the old blind boxer to teach him how to box. and it reminded me how the family used to do that. I won't mention any names because some of the people, but my mother, I felt, was a very attractive woman. And she, after raising us on the farm, she had these degrees. So she went back. She eventually became a judge, but she was the only woman as a legal researcher, as a judge. And there was a very prominent person who kept sexually harassing her. And in those days, in the 70s, I don't think there were HRs, right?
Right.
So she just told my dad. And he was, almost 6'4". He weighed about 230. So he just, he was kind of scared me. But he just went in one day and he walked into her chambers and the other judge was there and he just picked him up. I mean, he grabbed him by the shoulders. The guy was kind of like a Nero physique, little spiny legs and a pot belly, and just picked him up like over his head and said, how long do you want to stay up here? And they became good friends after that. But the point I'm making is there was something about the Me Too. And I wrote an article and I said, part of the problem with Me Too is the breakdown of the family. Because I can remember in the old days that just what you're talking about, dads, brothers, children, sons, they protected women. And that, I know that sounds awful, chauvinistic, patron, but that's what they did. There was a larger family network. And if anybody made a pass, in an untoward pass, or even sense to their safety was in danger, the family rallied, as they did males as well that were young. And I wrote that, and one of my colleagues got so angry and said I was a sexist and attacked me on social media. But I didn't mean it to be provocative. I thought it was just wise that everybody, did that. And we had four of us and one. We had two first cousins that grew up as basically our brother and sister, because their mother had died very early, my mom's sister. And we all rallied around our one female sibling, and we all, that old stereotype when I think every guy that came to ask her out was terrified, of us four.
Right. Right. And that was handsome. Yeah.
Yeah. Because everybody, we'd say something to,
right.
We'd say to her, this guy's a wimp, or this guy's okay, or this guy. And I know that sounds bad today, but that was a protective apparatus. And I had two daughters, and same thing with my son. He was very, very protective of his two daughters. He's kind of a big guy and he was that way. And there was at one period, I had a lot of people come up out to this farm to date my daughters, and I didn't like some of them, and I would talk to them. But that's all gone. I think because of the breakdown of the family. And so if you had a daughter who was a great volleyball player and she had a guy, you know, in practice, a man who was a female who was slamming the ball down her throat, right?
Yeah.
Or a basketball player on another team that kept flattening her because of his muscular skeletal advantage, you would want to do something. And
right.
And I think that's,
I think punch the administrators also.
Yeah, I think that's good. I know that a sign of a pre-civilizational society is the monopoly of violence is not with the state, it's with the tribe. But there was something to be said in the old days that the tribe protected their own vulnerable family members, and you didn't want to.
I think it would be a great shame if you did not. So, well, anyway, Victor, we are at the end here, except to say a few things. One, subscribe to The Blade of Perseus. If you're a new listener to the show, but of course you're here because you're a fan of Victor, go there, victorhanson.com. You'll see a ton of stuff you can read and link to. Victor's American Greatness essays and syndicated column, other writings. Archives of this podcast, his forthcoming book, link to that, The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. That will be out March 7th. You will see these other articles that have a little label on them. It's called Ultra, and you will click and you will not be able to read them unless you are subscribed. And Victor writes 2 or 3 Ultra pieces a week. $5 gets you in the door. A discounted full year subscription is $50. So that's The Blade of Perseus, victorhanson.com. I am Jack Fowler and the author of a free weekly email newsletter called Civil Thoughts. And I write that for the Center for Civil Society at AMPIL, where we are trying to strengthen civil society. Civil Thoughts ends up in your inbox every Friday. It's got 14 recommended readings of important, worthwhile, interesting pieces I've come across in the previous week. Gives you the excerpt, gives you the link. Well, sign up at civilthoughts.com and be assured we're not selling your name. We're not using your name for any other purposes. There's nothing transactional about this. If you're on Twitter, also known as X, Victor's handle is at VD Hansen. There is a wonderful friends group on Facebook, the Victor Davis Hanson Fan Club. It's nothing formally to do with Victor. It's just some great, great folks who follow his every jot and tittle, Victor. My gosh, they may even have a spy camera or drone over your house. Well, you know, the people will love you there. So that's on Facebook. But Victor also has VDH's Morning Cup on Facebook. What else? I think that's about all the linkage I need to raise. And for those who rate the show on iTunes and Apple, thank you. We follow it all the time. And also read the comments that people leave on Victor's website. You can rate the show 0 to 5 stars, and Victor gets a 4.9 plus average. Thanks for those folks who do that, for those who leave comments also. Here's one. It's titled The Building of a Gaza Harbor. I see the building of a harbor as only the first step. The U.S. will need to assure the delivery of the aid to the people, and that will be Biden's next step. Military convoys protected by our military. Before you know it, this endeavor becomes Somalia, with the U.S. troops assuring aid deliveries, and eventually the Hamas fighters will begin hit-and-run attacks on the U.S. convoys, and then it repeats the Battle of Mogadishu. That becomes an entanglement that is difficult to leave and will lead to casualties. That's from Stantastic 00. We get all kinds of praise and sometimes criticism, and then also some wise analyses on these comments. So thank you, Victor. You've been terrific as ever. And folks, thanks for listening. And we will be, if I can only, I sound like Porky Pig there, Victor. That's all, folks. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. See you next time.